It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Are the top law enforcement officers in our states becoming more political in their challenges to the Trump administration? And a new initiative to crack down on violent crime in Pittsburgh. Does this one have any better chance to succeed than its predecessor? But first, will he or won't he? A commission created by President Donald Trump asked him to declare a state of emergency over the nation's opioid epidemic. First, he declined. Yesterday, according to a White House poll report, he changed his mind. Joining us by phone to talk about the declaration and its impact, its windfall, Alana Gordon, health and science reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome, Alana.
Thanks so much for having me.
And in studio is Megan Guza, crime reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back, Megan.
Thanks for having me back.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. The recommendation came from a preliminary draft of a commissioned report that estimated nearly 60,000 people died in 2016 across the country from opioid overdoses alone, a 20% increase over the previous year, the biggest jump in overdose deaths of any kind in U.S. history. The commission's preliminary report said, quote, with approximately 142 Americans dying every day, America is enduring a death toll equal to September 11th every 3 weeks, end quote. So let's start with, what are we seeing in Pennsylvania? Alana, we're going to start with you then, Megan.
So actually in Pennsylvania, it seems like the overdose deaths are higher than that. It's about an average of 13 people a day, unfortunately. And here in Philadelphia last year, there was about or over 900, and local officials, first responders are expecting the number to be even higher this year.
And Megan, your coverage area, what are you seeing in southwestern Pennsylvania?
The same exponential jumps. I think the final count, when all was said and done in 2016, in Allegheny County, it was 649, up from 424 the year before, I believe. Even in the rural counties, you've got the rule of small numbers going on, but the jumps are still big. It's everywhere.
And to both of you, are officials, whether they're health officials, law enforcement, drug treatment people, are they getting frustrated? That seems like no matter what the efforts is, these numbers keep going up. Megan?
They're frustrated. They're disheartened. I had a, several months ago now, a county health official who I was speaking to about the epidemic. Before we hung up, she said to me, you know, if you think of anything, if you have any ideas,
oh my,
let me know.
Alana?
Yeah, it's something that's really been, you know, front and center, especially with the influx of fentanyl being mixed with heroin, and that's become more and more so a bigger issue. It's really surpassed, and I think now a recent report found that the majority of overdose deaths come from this much more potent synthetic opioid that's being mixed in with it. And, you know, the treatment systems are stressed. There's a big push in trying to promote a lot of more resources for medication-assisted treatment, which can be evidence is showing more and more that this can be a really important tool. There's been a huge blitz in naloxone, which is this overdose reversing drug. A lot of community members have it, first responders, and as you see more and more law enforcement also take this up, it's just becoming something that is front and center.
Those numbers that you both cited for the Philadelphia area and for Allegheny County, I mean, let's face it, they're discouraging enough, but a new study from the University of Virginia says it seems to be a lot worse than we know. That study found Pennsylvania underreports opioid deaths more than almost any other state because our death certificates for OD victims often don't list the specific drugs responsible.
Yeah, I think that's something that at least in Allegheny County and southwestern Pennsylvania, there's kind of a push to list those specifics. Overdose-free PA, the program with Pitt Public Health, and a bunch of coroners and the medical examiner in the area have started keeping counts of the specific drugs that are found in toxicology reports. So you can see 77 toxicology reports so far this year listed fentanyl. And that showed us last year that fentanyl, for the first time, outpaced heroin in terms of Allegheny County overdose deaths. And it's headed that direction and even higher so far this year based on what they've released so far.
What would a national emergency declaration mean for Philadelphia, for Pittsburgh, and everywhere between across the Commonwealth? Alana, let's start with you.
So I think it depends on the details of that. But based on that commission report, I'm hearing from a lot of the health leaders around here, one of the things that they really want is a focus on prevention and treatment and more resources for those things. So when you think about the treatment system, when somebody overdoses, for example, and then is in the hospital or is trying to connect with care for a longer-term plan in that process, it's a really complicated path. Recovery is really tricky. Even within Philadelphia, for example, the city treated, I want to say, 15,000 people last year just as it relates to opioids. And half, more than half, had relapsed before. So this is a really, really tricky epidemic and disease for people to get a handle on, and that just requires an all-hands-on-deck approach. So in terms of as it relates to prevention and treatment, more resources. There's also been a real focus and hope or concern about coverage for things like addiction treatment when it comes to what insurance covers, what Medicaid covers, and maintaining those things.
More resources seems to be kind of, you know, the name of the game right now. I know here in Allegheny County, the response to the preliminary draft of the commission's report was pretty much, we'll take whatever you're willing to send our way. The focus does need to be on prevention, and I think anyone will tell you that. The issue is, I think, we don't know how to prevent it yet.
Right. So Lana was talking about the it depends on what the details are. So Health and Human Services could make grants. There could be access to money under the Public Health Emergency Fund, but we'll have to find out the details of whether there'll be additional funds pumped into these accounts, if you will. We talked so far about Allegheny County and the Philadelphia area. Do we have any sense of really how this might help the rural areas, which maybe get underreported in terms of the problem there, but also access to resources, access to treatment facilities, which one would assume are fewer and farther apart?
Yeah, they are fewer and farther apart, not just in the rural areas of southwestern Pennsylvania, but, you know, all across the mid-state. And in a lot of these lower-income rural areas, it could be, you know, an hour's drive to the nearest anything resembling a treatment facility. And if you don't have access to transportation, it's completely out of reach.
Alana?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is hitting all over the state. And, you know, it becomes a real issue. I've seen around here, for example, in Bucks County, a lot of the neighboring counties are trying to come up with resources for naloxone. You know, not too long ago, I was visiting a mental health department there where, you know, parents were coming in and people were trying to get access to this and other services and care, and compounded on that, still people are grappling with the stigma around all of this. So I would agree.
Abby Wilson, we talked to Abby. She's with the Allegheny County Health Department, and she says there's no debate about this crisis. Let's take a listen.
It's hard to think of you know, a person I discussed this with who hasn't been touched by it personally in some way, whether they have a history of addiction, a member of their family, a neighbor, a friend. It is ubiquitous and very, very personal.
Alana, does that sort of reflect the feelings of health officials in the eastern part of the state as well?
I would say so. And I mean, you know, this week in Philadelphia, the department here released a survey, which I think, you know, reflects a broader issue too of how this is kind of impacting so many pockets of the state and beyond, which is, here the survey was of adult residents, and one in three, 30% about, had reported that they'd used an opioid in the last year. And so what the whole health system, statewide and beyond, physician groups are dealing with is, you know, this buildup of the prescribing of opioids. And, you know, the opioids can serve as a lead into the use of heroin. And, you know, even in talking to an ER doctor this morning, they had reviewed the ER doc use at Thomas Jefferson Hospital. And when they were surveying patients who came in, patients who were using opioids had been using them for an average of 2 years. And it's really, you know, best practices for acute care for no more than 3 months to get to be thinking about that. So there is a disconnect. And of course, there's more specifics in terms of what is best for each patient. But I think that's kind of also the counter issue that the region and state is facing, is the prescribing end and how to balance, you know, patient needs, but also what's responsible prescribing. And so I have been seeing and talking with people about a shift, an effort to really shift that culture, but it's a huge challenge.
Yeah, you mentioned a few sentences back about the stigma and, you know, how everyone knows someone. I think a lot of people don't realize that. I talk to a lot of people who just really can't seem to grasp that, even though statistically they almost certainly know someone, or have, you know, a mutual friend who's been going through this. And I think that's a lot of that is the problem. I had a call from a reader yesterday who he was upset because, quote, the overdosing junkies made it, so he could not. They wouldn't give him Vicodin when he had teeth pulled at the dentist the other day. And that was, he related that back to, you know, this being declared a national emergency. Meanwhile, statistically, he knows someone who has probably dealt with substance abuse. So I think there are still, a lot of people are still wearing blinders, and that's really hindering things.
We just have a few minutes left. And in Philly, some use is concentrated in one geographic area. Ilana, I want you to tell us about the main open-air drug market you've been profiling for The Pulse. But first, let's hear a person that you spoke to there.
It's my body. Like, I need the dope to get well. You understand? It's not body strange in there, you know? It's people that have hard time, you know?
Yeah, so that was Irma, and she lives nearby. And basically, in a part of North Philly, Kensington area, for decades, it's been kind of the spot for what's been many see as one of the biggest outdoor or open heroin markets on the East Coast. And it's gained a big reputation for, you know, cheap and pure drugs. And so people over the decades, as heroin crept in the 90s, as factories closed and the economy tanked, even before that, this area just became a hub for that. And it's something that, as the opioid and prescribing and as the heroin use has gone up, it's become even more trafficked in this area. And so a lot of what, you know, has, it's almost become a kind of like visible symbol in some ways to what's been going on, but also a heightened focus around the challenges of really getting a handle on this whole thing. And so, you know, one of the things that the city recently has happened with pressure on the railroad company, because within this neighborhood there is a whole stretch of railroad tracks that sneaks through. And for decades, it's kind of turned into a default kind of shooting gallery, but in some ways refuge or place where people are going to get high, kind of hiding, you know, with that stigma, wanting to hide from and not show, maybe come in from the burbs or from other areas to kind of maintain and so this has become a spot that in recent weeks the city has pressured the railroad company to be closing down.
Okay.
But it's sort of become this kind of local, national, even international focus on the whole kind of representation of the heroin crisis in our country.
All right, in our remaining 30 seconds, just quickly, both of you, what do you hope to cover in terms of treatment options with or without this declaration of emergency? And we'll start with you, Megan.
Definitely medically assisted treatment. Vivitrol has become more and more in the news. It's an injection that stops the cravings, stops withdrawal, keeps you from getting high for a month. It's a once-a-month shot, but it's expensive, up to more than $1,000 per shot. Mm. But so far, people have said it works. So there's something that's working, but how do we get it to the people who need it and can't afford it?
And very briefly, Alana, what are you covering?
Yeah, I think continuity. I think addiction is a really complicated journey, and it's not just about, like, stopping using one day and suddenly you're better. And I think looking at how our entire health system and community system is able to really effectively, or the challenges and opportunities to better support people.
Thank you so much. Megan Guza is crime reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Alana Gordon is health and science reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Her report on the open-air drug market in Philadelphia airs next week on The Pulse, and you can hear that program at 1 and 9 p.m. on 90.5 WESA and at WESA.FM. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, a multi-level initiative to reduce violent crime failed in Pittsburgh several years ago, but officials are hoping for better cooperation this time around. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A grand piano traveled around the city on a trailer this week as part of Piano Day in Pittsburgh. Locals were encouraged to tickle the ivories at various locations around the city, including along the Overlook in Mount Washington and outside of Hines Hall. And after years of negotiations and prep, redevelopment at the 178-acre Almano site in Hazelwood could start as early as next week. Developers hope the $120 million project will revitalize the area. Find more at WESA.FM.
WESA is supported by the Natural Sleep Shop. Celebrating their fifth anniversary, the Natural Sleep Shop on Route 19 in Cranberry features organic, non-toxic mattresses and U.S.-made bedroom furnishings by Savirest, Naturepedic, and more. Details at thenaturalsleepshop.com.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin.
I'm a little shaky, honestly. What happened here in Pittsburgh today was electrifying.
That was David Kennedy in 2010, a national criminologist who created a program aimed at reducing drug and gang-related gun violence with a stick, maybe, heavy enforcement of the law, and a carrot helping some members who turn away from the gangs. He was excited that day about the beginning of PERC, Pittsburgh Initiative to Reduce Crime, but it never really took off. We're going to discuss what happened to PERC, but also a new anti-gang violence strategy in the city with Shelley Bradbury, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Shelley.
Thank you.
And also joining us in studio is David Harris, professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. David is also host of the very popular podcast produced by WESA, Criminal Injustice. Welcome back, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
So, what was the intention of PERC?
The intention of PERC was to reduce gun violence, particularly homicide, but all types of gun violence. This is the model based on David Kennedy's work from Boston in the early and mid-1990s, in which juvenile homicides by gun in Boston were out of control. He designed this response model to confront that problem. It had almost miraculous results, thus the Boston miracle. That was the way it was labeled. And since then, Kennedy and his associates have taken this approach across the country, different cities, different sizes, and in most places, it's really produced some pretty startling results. Not everywhere, but in many places. So the idea was to replicate this here in Pittsburgh and to reduce gun violence.
Replicate and adapt, or just one size fit all?
Well, that's the question. I mean, there's an approach, there's a theory, there's a set of of things that you do and players that you must have. It is always subject to adapting to the individual environment, but to make it work, the whole picture has to be there in most respects.
So, Shelley, in your reporting on this new initiative that has begun, you did a look back as well at PERC. What was the takeaway you got from it? Did it fade away or did it just outright fail?
Well, if you asked David Kennedy, he would say it just outright failed. I talked with him recently this week for that story, and he said specifically, you know, PERC didn't even exist. He was like, we said it was happening, we wanted it to happen, but it didn't actually happen. So that was a very blunt way of saying this program didn't work because it wasn't properly executed here in Pittsburgh.
All right. Execution. What about buy-in? Was there a lack of buy-in or outright resistance from the Pittsburgh Police Bureau? Did they even feel like they were being big-footed by the federal authorities? Let's face it, the feds can wave a pretty big stick.
I don't think they felt big-footed by the federal authorities. This was primarily, if not entirely, locally based. The local authorities, the mayor then, Councilman Ricky Burgess, different people wanted it here. What seemed to have happened is that the police department internally did not cooperate in the ways that are important. It has several important aspects or elements, and one is you have to get the information and intelligence necessary to pinpoint the active gang members, and the police department, according to Kennedy, did not cooperate at all on that.
Yeah, in fact, at the time, he called them the most condescending and aggressively uncooperative agency that he had ever encountered in his time. And as we said, he had been replicating this across the country at that point by the time he ended up in Pittsburgh.
So you said they weren't big-footed, but I remember being there. I attended that news briefing after that first call-in, and you had at the time the acting U.S. attorney who was there. You did have the police chief. You did have Councilman Burgess. You had the mother of a gun violence victim. You had a former gang member. They all got up, and they were all excited, like you heard David Kennedy at the beginning of our discussion right here. But that excitement did seem to quickly fade away.
Well, it takes cooperation across agencies, not just the leadership. And in fact, on the police side, you have to have people who are involved in the middle management of the department who are going to execute the chief's orders and the mayor's priorities. If you don't get that kind of cooperation, a strategy can fail right there. The other thing is that when you call in the gang members, that's the idea. You tell them there's a new sheriff in town, literally, and we want the violence to stop, and if it doesn't stop, we're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. We're going to pull every lever, federal, state, local, and we're going to get your whole organization shipped off to prison. The other thing is you have to offer an exit to anybody who wants out of the gangs and out of the life in the form of social services, education, jobs, and job training. And that never really came together here. That's the other half of the strategy, and my information was that that never happened either.
All right. So Pittsburgh officials, they're trying again. Group violence intervention is what it's known as. 7 years after that introduction of PERC, David, you talked with David Kennedy earlier this year, I believe, for your podcast. And David Kennedy described what drives his work, whether it is PERC or racial reconciliation or violence intervention.
It is a fact about civil society that if the law does not work, if the state is not effective at preventing violence, in assisting people who are in trouble, in stepping in effectively after there is violence, and in having a fundamentally correct and legitimate relationship with communities and the public, if those things are not true, then historically and in all kinds of settings, you get high levels of violence.
Shelley, David?
Well, David is describing there what goes on when the police fail to address the core concept of keeping people safe from murderous violence on the street. And what he's saying is that you have to do that first. Otherwise, the other efforts involved in public safety and involved in binding a community together will fail. And that's the core of his idea. You have to get the shooting and the killing to stop. That's what he's directed at.
And that's also an important part of what they're doing. As they look at it, they're only focusing on gun violence. They don't care if you're dealing drugs on the corner. They really just want you to put the guns down. So that's the message that they give to these, the most violent people, is you don't have to become a choir boy. You can continue dealing drugs. We're not asking you to put that down, but we are asking you to stop shooting. And that's really just the extent of the ask the police give these people.
And when he does that, the idea is if you can get that big, big problem addressed, other things, whether it's drug dealing or other community concerns, can begin to be addressed in more helpful ways with both the community and the police together. If the gun violence continues, there's no hope of that.
So is the philosophy any different from PERC, this new initiative, the group violence intervention versus the Pittsburgh initiative to reduce crime? Is the basic philosophy the same?
The basic philosophy is exactly the same. It's the same approach of trying to find the most violent people in the city and targeting only those people and asking those people just to put the guns down. And then also coupling that with the social services. And, you know, if you put the guns down, we will help you adjust back to life as a civilized person who's not shooting. So it's the same approach.
So why might this succeed in terms of, David, you mentioned that you thought one of the reasons why PERC failed was there wasn't, although there was this sort of promise
yes.
for social services and getting people onto the right path with assistance, with help, so it didn't come to fruition. If that is also an approach this time around, how do we know that those services will actually be provided?
Well, that's a great question, Kevin. And what it goes to is we will have to see what exactly is happening. There will have to be transparency this time. And so what we should look for as members of the public or members of the press are indications, reports, and regular updates, if you like, on the two critical things that weren't there last time. Number one is the broader provision of social services and supports. Number two, how is it going with the sharing of data from the police department to the effort? How is that happening? If those two things are on track, there will be a reasonable chance for this to succeed. If they do not happen, if there is obstruction or a failure to raise the money and the social capital aspects of it, we could be in for the same ending, and nobody wants that.
On both sides of the strategy, on both the enforcement side and the social services side, the key is legitimacy and credibility. So if police say we're going to crack down on you, we're going to bring everything we can to shut you down, and then they don't, the strategy will not work. And on the social services side, if they say, you know, we'll get you a job, we'll buy you diapers, whatever you need,
right,
and then they don't, again, the strategy won't work. So really, it's just a matter of follow through on what they've said they're going to do.
Shelley, you mentioned David Kennedy's take on why it failed, and he put the blame strictly on mostly on the Bureau of Police. I was talking with Mayor Peduto about this new initiative, the group violence intervention. He says there's a whole different attitude now in the police command structure and rank and file. Is this also a wait and see, or do you sense that there is?
I was not here when the first
right.
program was put in place, so I can't speak to how it was then, but I have spoken with the people who are running it now, and they seem very passionate and excited to pull this off. Both Cornell Jones, who was hired as to do the social services side for the police, and then also Sergeant Glick, who was handling the gang violence intervention unit itself.
They used, I believe, a DOJ grant, Department of Justice grant to hire
they did.
Cornell Jones
to do
that. It was
120,000, yeah.
Right. And David?
I think there's been enough change in the police department that we could be cautiously optimistic, certainly. If you look at it from the side of the people to whom the strategy was pitched initially, it would be perfectly logical for them to say, well, we'll wait and see. We'll measure what we get. But so far, people seem much more open. And sometimes having a failure can teach you what you really need to do. So I think there's reason to be cautiously optimistic, certainly.
All right. We've been talking about police buy-in, police attitude, and the different officers. But what about community leaders? Have they weighed in so far? Has there been any comments? And is there any doubt, any lingering disappointment from the last time from PERC? Have we heard anything?
I think there's certainly some lingering doubts, especially considering how solidly the program failed to work last time it was put in place. Some council people are asking again for that accounting and transparency in the process. And community members seem like they've been more involved in the rollout of this time. They've had several meetings with police and have been able to sort of give their input and their buy-in. So I think there's more rounded support for it among the community members. But really the key people that have to buy into this are the group members themselves. If they don't believe this, it won't change their behavior.
I have to ask you, you keep saying the name of the thing is group violence intervention. Gang is not mentioned. Is that purposely, or is it not the gang structure anymore, or what?
Well, you know, this has been an issue with these programs from the beginning. The Boston police back in the 90s did not want to say, we have a gang problem. And the same thing was true here when the initial effort was announced back in 2010. We don't have gangs here. So this is a way for everybody to be able to acknowledge that there are groups of people, and they could be called X, they could be called Y. That's less important than acknowledging that there are groups of people engaged in consistent violent behaviors that result in deaths and injuries. So it gives everybody a way to join the effort, no matter whether you think we're infested with gangs or we don't have gangs.
It also allows, there's a perception among, I would say, the public that gangs are highly organized, they have a top dog,
yes,
and then they have the structure down. And I think group is an attempt to push back against that perspective or that perception by saying group, there might be 5 people, there might be 12 people, there might be 50 people, and they don't necessarily have that top-down organized structure. They're just like people who grew up together or who met each other in some other way and bonded together.
We have about a minute left, and I want to get your sense of what you'll be keeping an eye on. Shelley, for your reporting, what will you be wanting to see what develops? And David, from your analysis, what you want to see develop to see if this actually becomes a success? David, we'll start with you.
Well, I think the things to watch are the provision of the social services part of it, and then whether the data is flowing to the people who need it, and whether there's transparency about those things. We'll certainly be able to see when there is a crackdown, when a gang doesn't put the guns down after they've been told and so forth. That'll be visible. We need to see that these other things are there, and then we need to see the quiet descend, because that's what the promise is.
And Shelley, as you follow up on the story that you did recently, what will you be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, definitely. We want to be looking at the follow through on the social services side. You know, how many people are getting help? What kind of help are they getting? How many people are landing jobs and keeping jobs or getting training? And then on the enforcement side, really it just comes down to is gun violence going down or not? So we've had 86 shootings as of the end of June this year. And the year prior, we had 98. And the year prior to that, we had 78. So
fatal shootings?
Those are non-fatal.
Okay.
So it is essentially level to where we were a couple of years ago. So really the key metric here is to see if this program is effective, is what's happening with our gun violence. Is it going down?
Shelley Bradbury is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. David Harris is host of the WESA podcast, Criminal Injustice, and a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Thanks so much to both of you.
Good being with you, Kevin.
Of course.
Coming up on The Confluence, we are going to talk about the growing political power about the state attorneys general in this nation. That's next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra plays for about 5,000 people at the Steelers training camp in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. The 1989 performance of Stars and Stripes Forever was a tribute to Steelers founder Art Rooney Sr., who had died the previous August. The symphony was directed by former coach Chuck Knoll. The orchestra also performed earlier this year, following the death of Art's oldest son, Dan. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for August 11th, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Republican attorneys general from several states team up to pressure the EPA to implement a new rule on smog and ozone standards. Then Democratic AGs partner to challenge President Trump's first travel ban. We're going to talk about the growing political back and forth of state attorneys general with Mike Warshak, an investigative reporter with The Caucus, a weekly print-only newspaper covering state government and politics. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone from Harrisburg is Paula Knutson, also an investigative reporter with The Caucus. Welcome, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
Power and partisanship was the headline of a recent cover story by The Caucus on this idea of the politicization of state attorneys general. So was it the frequency of the challenges to executive orders or decisions by the Trump administration or something else that led you to this exploration?
Well, I got interested in it towards the end of the Obama administration when you started to, when the number of challenges by state attorneys general really began to add up. And then as we got into the Trump administration, you saw the same pace of activity continuing, but it had switched to the Democratic Party. And that seemed to me to be a significant change and something worth taking a deeper look at.
Paula, what sparked your interest?
Well, I've covered a lot of issues related to the Attorney General, and the caucus launched in January of this year, and Attorney General Shapiro was one of the first interviews we did. So a lot of reporting we do focuses on state government. Obviously, the Attorney General's office is a major component of state government. I also have a background as a lawyer, so to me it's interesting to see what the chief lawmaker in the state is up to, the law enforcer, rather.
So the Attorney General Shapiro stopped by the WESA studios this week. Let's hear a little bit from him.
And so that traditional set of horizontal checks and balances that we all learned about in school, Congress, the judiciary, and the executive, the president, really, I think, is stepping aside for a really robust set of vertical checks and balances where the states, attorneys general, governors, and others, become a check on the federal government.
All right, Paula. Shapiro told me that he believes that this checks and balances by Congress has actually weakened over the last four administrations, the Clinton administration, Bush, Obama, and now the Trump administration. Your thoughts?
In our reporting in June, he talked about a similar approach, really the attorney generals of the Democratic side banding together and trying to push back on what he viewed as infringements and really kind of an ultimate level of protection. And I think, Mike, you found the same thing on the Republican side as well.
Yeah, that's true. You see the Republican attorneys general stepping up during the Obama administration trying to in fact, they were the ones who successfully stopped Obamacare's Medicaid exemption expansion.
Yeah.
By challenging the denial of state of federal funds to states who did not adopt that expansion. It became voluntary, and you see this now wide disparity across the country. It had a major policy impact on what is maybe the most vociferous debate we've had over the last decade or so.
Okay, so we're talking about political challenges, one party against another in a sense. But many attorneys general have partnered before to go after a business or industry that they felt was harming the citizens of their respective states. For example, the suit and settlement with the tobacco industry.
Yeah, Walter Cohen, who had been he was first deputy attorney general in Pennsylvania for a number of years in the mid-90s. He was acting attorney general for a few months after his boss ended up going to jail. And he said that the tobacco settlement was actually the first time that you see attorneys general realizing that they can play a role in a major national issue and that they can swing the, you know, they can push the needle in one direction or another. Congress couldn't take on tobacco. The president couldn't take on tobacco. Governors couldn't take on big tobacco. The AGs got together and they completely changed the landscape. And Walter Cohen sees that as a kind of a watershed moment for them. It's when they all sort of woke up to this idea that, wait a minute, this is not solely limited to the states. This has the possibility of major national policymaking, in a sense.
Well, Paula, did they feel emboldened by these victories, shall we say?
Absolutely. I mean, over the years, as you mentioned, the attorneys generals from many states have gotten together in a bipartisan fashion to go after issues, whether it's tobacco or some other consumer issue. With the mortgage meltdown, some attorneys generals got involved in that. But here in the reporting we've done recently, a lot of the political science professors who we talked to said that rather than just kind of working together regardless of party, we've now seen a shift where there's a politicizing that hasn't happened before. And a political science professor from Widener University, Professor LaCrone, called it an arms race between the two sides. And Mike, I don't know if you can talk a little bit more about, you know, the kind of unspoken agreement between the two sides that had happened and now is a little different.
Yeah. There was, for a long time, Republican and Democratic attorneys general, they each have their own associations, and they would not campaign. There was this rule that they would not campaign against incumbents. And the reason is because of these cross-border cooperation investigations. And you need them. I mean, your earlier segment, your first segment on this show was about the opioid crisis.
Right.
Well, drug trafficking is not limited to Pennsylvania. It's going to come in from Ohio. It's going to come in from Michigan. These are major problems that require, you know, cooperation well beyond state borders. And for a long time, that need is what kept these two sides from going after each other. That all changed in March. In March, the Republican Attorneys General Association voted to start going after Democratic incumbents. And it seems, you know, that arms race comment from Mr. LaCrone is referring to the belief and the expectation, really, that Democratic attorneys general are going to follow suit because you can't just unilaterally disarm. They're coming for him now.
So the unwritten rule has sort of been torn up?
Yeah, it has, in fact, been written the other way.
And if you look at each of the associations, the Democratic Associations, General Association, and the Republicans, I mean, both of them are touting their efforts against the other side. For the Republicans, they talk about their efforts in fighting President Obama's EPA regulations. And for the Democrats, they explicitly talk about the current administration and what they're doing to band together. They start out with some videos on their website led by an attorney general from Washington, Bob Ferguson. The third person on their site is Attorney General Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania. So, I mean, these attorney generals all throughout the country are really playing these higher-level roles within the parties.
So Josh Shapiro, Pennsylvania's attorney general, he said, it's not partisan. It's not a protest. He says he's fighting for, quote, the rights of the people of Pennsylvania. Here again, Josh Shapiro.
I don't sue Donald Trump every opportunity I get. In fact, a lot of times my colleagues, my attorney general colleagues, sue the president, and I don't get involved in those suits. Because to me, the test is very simple. It's not whether I like something the president's doing or don't like something the president's doing. And to me, it's not about preference. It is about the rule of law.
Yeah, that is the argument that both sides make. Even when it is when there is a challenge to a federal policy that is joined only by Republican attorneys general or only by Democratic attorneys general, their argument isn't this is good for the party. This is the Republican goal. Their argument is this is not constitutional. This is not legally within your rights to do. And it bears mentioning that the courts have agreed with that. These challenges are not completely frivolous. I mean, you have courts ruling in favor of challenges brought only by AGs of one party, which tells you that, you know, they're on to something.
Mm-hmm. Paula?
And here in Pennsylvania, you know, one of the more high-profile decisions comes from Shapiro's predecessor, former Attorney General Kathleen Kane, who declined to argue for the state laws against same-sex marriage. I mean, that was a huge decision on her part. She pinned that on her understanding of the constitutionality of the laws that were at play there, but that really helped to kind of position her as someone who was, at the time, really highly regarded. And it was a decision that had both political implications as well as legal implications. So these decisions that are made by attorney generals throughout the country really can be played for political reasons, but do have that solid legal underpinning that both sides can argue.
The attorney general's office in Pennsylvania has been an elected post, I believe, since 1980. Is it naive to think it wouldn't become political eventually, especially in the current climate? Mike, then Paula.
Yeah, I think it's easy to see why you could be thought of as being naive for thinking that, it wouldn't become politicized. But I don't think it's that simple. I mean, I think there's a reason why these offices are expected to be more apolitical. There is something important here. This is about the rule of law, like Josh Shapiro was saying. And if the rule of law becomes just one more arena of partisan disagreement, it is, I mean, in the words of Bruce Ledowitz, Duquesne University law professor we talked to for this, he said that is a catastrophe. This is about something bigger than partisan gain. And I don't think it's naive to expect public officials to act in the public good rather than the party's good.
Paula?
And here, in terms of, we've been talking a lot about at the federal level, different laws that have been challenged. But Shapiro, you know, we asked him at an editorial board meeting with LNP Media Group back in June about different laws legislation that his office was tracking. And he was emphatic in saying, I'm not a lawmaker, I'm a law enforcer. And really that he felt that the role of his office was to opine as to the constitutionality of a law and that there's a process for the AG's office to weigh in. He was really talking about it. He doesn't think it's his role to make policy. But, you know, there are policy and political implications that can come out of that office. And if you look at the history, you know, when Kane was making some of these high-profile moves like the same-sex marriage decision, she was being talked about for potentially a run at U.S. Senate. So they do have implications for political office, Corbett went on, of course, from the Attorney General's office. So I think it's difficult to see the office as not having any political implications.
The current EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, was the Attorney General for, I believe, Oklahoma. And he had he rose to national prominence by being sort of the chief person challenging President Obama's environmental regulations. And now he's running the EPA.
Just 30 seconds left, folks. Do you expect it to be Democratic attorneys general going after certain things and Republican attorneys general going after certain else? Or do you see a cooperation in challenging issues they feel affects their state? Just very briefly, Mike, then Paula.
I think it's going to be a bit of both. I think they're going to team up on things that they need to, but then there's also this partisan component now that can't be ignored.
Paula?
Clearly the opioid issue is one everyone's cooperating on, trying to wipe out. But like Mike said, there are going to be issues that there will be a split on, and it will be litigated in the courts.
All righty. Paula Knutson and Mike Wershagen are investigative reporters for The Caucus, a weekly print-only newspaper covering state government and politics. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And finally, Wednesday marked the 81st anniversary of Jesse Owens winning his fourth gold medal at the 36th Berlin Summer Olympics, sort of infuriating the Fuhrer. Many years later, as a young reporter, I covered a news conference featuring Mr. Owens here in Pittsburgh. I immediately violated a journalistic rule. Be courteous, professional, but neutral. But it was Jesse Owens, an American hero. And I asked for an autographed photo. He gave it to me of his running in the 36th Olympics. And it's still, all these years later, that autographed photo still sits proudly on my desk. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer, Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Have a good week of good news.